With advanced data protection, we're giving users the option to keep that key only on their devices, which means that even if an attacker were to successfully breach the cloud and access all that data, they'd lack the key to decrypt. If your mother-in-law had set up you, say, as her recovery contact, you would actually be able, with information you couldn't use directly, but that you could use to assist her, you'd be able to help her recover her data that was protected with advanced data protection.
Apple requires you set up a backup recovery method in case you need to recover end-to-end encrypted data. One option, a recovery contact, where you can set up a friend or family member to assist you with recovering info. There's also a recovery key option, so you can generate a key that you can print out and keep in a secure location.
We really have the same mission at heart, which is to keep people safe.
We've talked in past shows about the United Kingdom Snoopers Charter, the Investigatory Powers Act, which the United Kingdom had decided. Apparently, it's not public, but rumor had it, and a number of news organizations confirmed it, had sent a letter to Apple saying, you must provide us with unencrypted access to anything stored on iCloud, including advanced data protection, which is end-to-end encrypted. Apple does not have the keys to that intentionally. They don't want to be able to respond to subpoenas from law enforcement and say, you know, here's what's in Larry's iCloud. UK said not only are they going to require Apple, and presumably it leaked out about Apple, but presumably that's everybody else too. They could easily have sent the same letter to Google and Signal and a bunch of other people. But they said you must provide unencrypted access, a backdoor in effect, to this iCloud information, not just for UK citizens, but for everybody worldwide. Hmm. Which, of course, raised the hackles of the U.S. Congress, and letters were exchanged, angry words were exchanged. Apple has decided to remove advanced data protection for UK users. We will never build a backdoor to user data, says Apple.
Well, here we are. Back with another one. This is Simon, Closed Network Privacy and Security Podcast, recorded today, Wednesday, Wednesday, February 26th, 2025. Hope you're all doing well. It's been a lot of chatter, a lot going on. And I've been following as much of it as I possibly can. And wow, where do we begin? Where do we start? If you are keeping a pulse on news and information regarding, you know, just big tech in general, you undoubtedly have seen articles about Apple and the UK, the United Kingdom, in regards to this secret order, this Investigatory Powers Act that was passed in 2016. So that's going to be a big topic. I'm going to be kind of touching, I'm not going to, there's a few aspects I want to talk about that specifically in this episode. So yeah, that's, I don't even have a title yet. I mean, I've got my notes, I've got everything together, and I just didn't really know what to title this yet. So I don't exactly know what the title will be. Maybe you could help me with that. But I will be talking about Apple and this whole advanced data protection unwinding for UK citizens, as well as kind of a follow-up to this, which is interesting, has come out in the last few days. The FBI warns iPhone and Android users that they want lawful access to all your encrypted data, which is just doesn't make sense to me at all. So I'm going to touch on that as well as some other news stories. I'm not really sure how many I will get to them. So if I don't, I know which ones I'm going to try to get to. And for the other ones, they'll be in the show notes. If you're listening to this in a traditional podcast app, I try to put the link at the top so you can click on that. It'll take you to the forum post for the show notes. So it's very easy to like just click to the thing that you want to read more about. Sometimes I put YouTube videos, definitely links to articles, summaries of stories, I'll write and put that in there as well. So feel free to jump over there and take a look. So we're going to talk about this whole UK demanding a backdoor for Apple. I'm also going to touch on Google using AI to determine if you're lying about your age and what that means. Some updates to Mulvad VPN, partnering with Obscura VPN to try to masquerade entry data and exit data, almost kind of like a separation of data storage, trying to create a more private browsing experience for Mulvad users. We're going to talk a little bit about Microsoft, what they're doing, trying to monetize a watered-down version of Office with ads and kind of my thoughts around that. If I can get to it, I'll talk a little bit about Mozilla, a major data breach that hackers are basically trying to exploit data from. A very cool story about an engineer who did some research on his own iPhone, creating a new profile, and was able to triangulate his own location based on the information that was being transmitted from the phone. I'll have a couple articles about some crypto stealing apps found in the Apple App Store, which is pretty new. This is the first time we've seen that. There's a spyware maker, Paragon, and it's been confirmed that the U.S. government is a customer. It's a TechCrunch article, so I might try to get to that, as well as who is behind the seized forms of Cracked and Nulled. So if I don't get to that, there's a Krebs on Security article. There was a Grubhub data breach impacting customers, drivers, and merchants. That's pretty big, at least in the United States. Again, I've mentioned in previous episodes, not a huge data breach news breaker. I think, as I say, it's assumed that everything will be breached at some point, but this is a kind of a big deal. And I'd like to kind of also talk about what you can do and what I'm planning to do. Not planning, I'm actually working on it right now for self-hosting options. And if I say self-host and you cringe because you think it's too technical, I get that. But I think we're getting to that boiling point where you've got to decide what you're going to do sometime sooner than later if you care about who has access to your data and what you feel about that. So I've been working on some new implementations for my own home lab. Home lab is just a reference to servers or equipment in my house that basically I'm using to run servers for various reasons. And I'm going to get into that, talking about that and network attached storage. I would like to also talk about RSS if I can get to it, and kind of reevaluating how you get your news and being able to aggregate information into places that you can glean and read from, as opposed to being bombarded through social media and what the news sites put is they're breaking stories and trying to find ways to create your own version of ground news, if that makes sense. I don't know if you're familiar with ground news. I've used ground news on and off for I don't know, the last year or so, where it aggregates stories and tries to provide some insights into which way what it's editorialized or breaking news, which way it's leaning, left, right, center, that kind of thing. And I'd like to really build my own version of that for myself that's all self-hosted. So I'm going to talk about that as well as also some social media stuff. So that's what I'm going to talk about in this episode. If that sounds of interest to you, I'd love for you to hang out. And if not, that's cool. Maybe I'll catch you in the next one. I try to cover everything in the very beginning so you don't have to sit there and listen to an hour and a half or so of me babbling and with nothing interesting to listen to. So hopefully that's helpful. Definitely going to just give a quick shout out to the supporters of the podcast. This show is fully supported by myself and you, the producers of the show, adopting a value for value model, which is not a model I created. It's one I stole, rightfully stole from the Podfather. And that would be, I'm referring to Adam Curry, who's the Podfather. And their model I've always enjoyed over the last probably 10 or 11 years of listening to No Agenda podcast. So there's a shout out there, which is basically there's no sponsors. There's no money or influence from any kind of special interest or entity, commercial outfit. It's just people like you who either donate through time, talent, or treasure. And so this is the moment where I say thank you to the Patreon supporters, especially the Privacy Badass tiers and our Lightning contributors. So Patreon, Michael Bates, Richard G., Daniel J. Martin, Timothy Kelly, Hutch, thank you all very much. Super appreciated. Got plans for building out some more infrastructure that's really going to help support the show, I think, long term. That's going to be things like XMPP servers, potentially Simple X chat servers. On the topic of Simple X chat, I also want to mention something about Signal too, if I don't forget. And of course, Wartime, Bond, 42, some of the top Lightning contributors. Thank you for the support. These are contributions coming in through Bitcoin Satoshis, through Lightning Network with Podcast 2.0 apps. I like using Podcast 2.0 apps because, number one, there's a lot more privacy. If you're using, say, an iPhone and you use Apple Podcast, Apple actually does track what you listen to and how often. And I don't think that's any of their business. So I don't know what Google tracks. I've actually not really ever used, not ever. It's been a long, long time since I've ever used stock Android OS with like the Google ecosystem apps. So I don't really know. Now I'm a heavy Android user in the context of using de-Googled versions of AOSP like Graphene OS on different Pixels since now almost 2020. I think it's almost been not quite 5 years, but this will be the fifth year I've been in that end of the pool, if you will. Started out with Calyx OS at the end of 2019, I think, or beginning of 2020, and quickly migrated over to Graphene OS because I just really felt like that was a better fit for what I was trying to accomplish. And anyways, thank you for all the support, and thank you to our moderators, Unintelligent 7 and Mattis Max, who help moderate the channels within our Matrix chat rooms, as well as helping me run servers and moderate our Mastodon server, our discourse forum, as well as various other things that they're helping me with all the time and making themselves available to do things like migrating servers and all that fun stuff. So if you happen to see them in the Matrix chat, just give them a heads up and say thank you, a shout out for being here and helping run things. Of course, there's also producers of the show who send me information. I want to give a special shout out to Some Ordinary Guy, who always is feeding me great articles and information regarding encryption and VPNs and Apple infiltration, especially in India, because I don't always, I can't keep the whole globe on my radar all the time. So when people send me stuff, it really helps a lot because it points me into another scope, another area that I just don't have a pulse on. And the reason why I bring that up is because he's been sending me a lot of information about what's been happening within India and this whole big marketing culture push towards Apple and having FOMO, fear of missing out by not having an Apple device, and really elevating the social status when using an iPhone or an Apple Watch and these different things, and how big of a stranglehold that has on people of various ages, various generations. So thank you for that information. Some ordinary guy who's a fellow Linux user, I've had many conversations with over the last couple of years in relation or in talking about like Pop OS and different things. So regarding the chats, if you feel like you are all out there by yourself, you're not. There's a bunch of us. We're all in the same boat. And all you have to do is download and install the Element app. I mean, there are other Matrix clients you can surely use. The Element app is one of the easier ones. And so you can download it. Doesn't matter what device. It could be your phone, could be your computer. And just create an account. And then just go to our website, closednetwork.io, and click join the Matrix chat. And you'll pop in and introduce yourself. So that's kind of where a lot of conversations, I would say 90% of our conversations happen. And then some of the other various areas like our SimpleX chat and our off topic and things of that nature. So if you want to get connected, that's kind of where to start. We have currently 323 people in the chat room, which is awesome. And I learn a lot, bouncing a lot of information around with other people and asking questions. We're all kind of there for the same stuff. Keep it cool. Keep it kind. Everyone has a viewpoint, whether it's on technology or politics, but we try to keep everything very, very cool, baby. Just be cool, be kind. And, that's pretty much all I have to say about that. So on the topic, of Apple, as I was just mentioning about with some ordinary guy, we saw this article come out. It was actually the Washington Post that broke the story on February 7th. There was a leak. I don't know where the leak came from, if it was from within Apple or a connection, but obviously there was a leak because this Investigatory Powers Act that was passed in 2016 in the UK, actually part of it is if you are contacted by the UK government to provide information, you can't talk about it. It's actually part of their law. So it's basically a secret order. And the clip I played in the beginning, the first one, the very first clip I played was actually an interview by Craig. Well, I always forget how to pronounce his last name. Why can I not say? I always feel like I'm going to screw it up. But Craig Federighi, right? He's the one that was talking about advanced data protection or about the privacy app. That's Apple and this and that and the other. And the second clip I played was actually a clip from Leo Laporte, who's a longtime podcaster. This Week in Tech, he used to be on a TV show I used to watch when I was a young boy called the Tech TV or G4 TV. I can't remember. I think it was called Tech TV. He was on a show called The Screensavers, and it was one of my favorite shows back then. And so anyways, it was just a clip from there, and I found it kind of contrasting. That's why I played the two, one after the other, because on the one hand, Apple's trying to walk this tightrope of providing the best service to their users and privacy and security. I would say security for sure, while also having to play by the rules in the countries they want to operate in. And so that becomes very difficult when your ethos is centered around privacy, but then at the same time you offer your service in countries like China, which they work with a company called GCBD, which I think is Guizhou Cloud Big Data, which basically is the iCloud provider for Chinese Apple users so that the Chinese can surveil everything within that data center, with all that within that cloud storage. So even though Apple wants to try to, you know, provide the best privacy and security to its end users, they have to abide by the laws in the countries they operate, and they're willing to do that because they want bigger market share. The whole point of a lot of these companies is to get more users on their system. And I would say that the U.S. market's fairly saturated for them. I don't know what the total numbers. I think it's somewhere around 65 to 70% of all mobile phone users in the United States use iPhones. That's a huge number, but that's not the case in the rest of the world. For instance, I think in India, the last number I read an article that some ordinary guy sent me was like 17% market share or somewhere around there. And it's pretty low in China. So Apple's going to do what they can to grow their user base, because yes, they want to sell hardware, but more than anything, they want to get people into their ecosystem and they want to sell them those services. And they get a big cut from everything you purchase through the Apple Store and other stores, right? Whether it's through Apple TV and all this other stuff. So they get a lot of money ongoing. The device is the gateway into their system, into their ecosystem. Yes, they make money on the hardware, but really they want you in their system as a lifelong customer. So there's a lot of push to bend to these governments because they kind of have to if they want to continue servicing their citizens. So this leak came out, and the Washington Post posted this on February 7th. This secret order requires blanket access to protected cloud backups around the world, which if implemented would undermine Apple's privacy pledge to its users. Well, it actually goes much further than that. I mean, yes, that's very true. And by the way, I don't look at this as just an Apple issue. Apple is just the one that we got the leak about. So as I'm talking about the story, this isn't just an Apple, they're not the only ones affected by this. It's just that they're the ones that had the leak. So, and remember, this is kind of another big deal, keeping this in the back of your mind, is that the UK is part of what's called the Five Eyes, which is the most intimate group of countries, which is Australia, Canada, New Zealand, United Kingdom, and the United States, in data sharing, having these data flows. So in the 90s, this Echelon project was disclosed, which was, you know, triggering a lot of debate in Europe and to a lesser extent in the United States, but British Parliament as well, when Edward Snowden kind of broke all the information about all this, collaborative spying efforts and how these countries were sharing information real time and violating a lot of privacy and even constitutional laws on unwarranted surveillance. So this is kind of an interesting move by the UK, even though they passed this law. We haven't really heard much or seen much with in the way of news as far as companies being contacted or whatever. But also, too, remember that part of this the secret order requires the companies to remain quiet. They can't talk about it. So if you got a request to have access to user data from the UK under this Investigatory Powers Act, you couldn't talk about it. You couldn't put out a press release. You couldn't even contact your end users about it. So security officials in the United Kingdom have demanded that Apple create a backdoor allowing them to retrieve all the content any Apple user from any Apple user worldwide had uploaded into iCloud. And that's kind of like the second part of this going like, well, you're not just asking for access to surveil your own citizens. You want access to all of it. So anyone on the planet with an iCloud account, you want to access their data. And the second part of this is we're going to talk about is advanced data protection, also referred to as ADP, which is something that was rolled out, I think, at the end of 2022, maybe 23. I know I opted into it on my iPhone the second it was available, which is Apple's extended end-to-end encrypted access for iCloud storage. So it is an opt-in thing. You have to opt into it. Well, long story short, Apple has decided to just, hey, we're not going to really give the UK access to everything, but what we'll do is we're going to turn off advanced data protection for UK citizens. So as of this moment, this very moment that you're listening to this, if you're in the UK and you go into your Apple settings to enable advanced data protection, it will actually tell you that it's you're not allowed. Now, for those that have already had it enabled, at some point, it's going to have to be disabled. And we don't know when. We just know that in order to comply, that that will have to be undone, which is going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how that's done. Now, it might be something that's done through an update. And if you have, this is my theory, Apple will roll out an update. And if you have an account, that an iCloud account registered in the UK, meaning like your billing information and that's where you live. I don't mean like you're just passing through, but you have an, that's where you live. And they have ways of knowing that because you have to KYC yourself when you set up your iCloud account with your name and your phone number and your credit card and all this other stuff. So I think what they'll probably do is there'll probably be some sort of flag that says, hey, when you run this update, you're going to have to agree. In order to get the update, you'll have to agree to disable ADP is my guess, or something like that. That these kinds of things are usually done through software updates because until the phone does update itself, it's kind of in a permanent state. So, you know, long story short, the UK is demanding for these backdoor access. And Apple's like, yeah, that's not going to happen. But here's the thing. This is only from what we know about. So I'm under the assumption that maybe these orders have also been issued to other large cloud service providers. Could be Dropbox. Well, I don't think Dropbox is in encrypted, but it doesn't matter if it's in encrypted. And if it is, you have to find a way to backdoor it. That's the whole messed up thing about this whole situation. So Google, what do we know? I mean, Google definitely provides services in the UK. How does that work with things like Google Messages or other data that's encrypted? I don't know. How does this affect Proton Mail or Proton Drive or Signal? Signal by default is end-to-end encrypted. There is no a way to issue another key, not to mention those keys change with every message sent. So you would have to have some sort of master key. I don't even think it's possible. The only way that I could see something like the Signal Foundation working to comply if they got some sort of order like Apple did was just to say, hey, we'll have to block connections to our servers from the UK, I guess. But that's easily circumvented too, because you could just run your own Signal relay on a $2-5 a month VPS in a different country and connect to it. I mean, like, and there's VPNs. Like, the more I thought about this, the more it kind of like my brain started melting because I'm thinking, how do you actually force this? I mean, it's easy to go after big companies because there is someone to sue there, but how do you stop individuals? And that's kind of where the theme is going to lead to with this episode is you as the individual, you actually have the power to say, like, I'm going to opt out of this, right? Whether it's self-hosting, running your own servers and things of that nature. And there might be some legal parameters or some legal blurred lines by doing these things, but that's kind of like where everyone, that's what I'm saying, everyone kind of starts carving out where their acceptability limits are for how much you're going to take from these governments. So an interesting thing is, though, we're talking a lot about the UK. Well, just 2 days ago, Forbes put out an article titled "The FBI Warns iPhone Android Users, We Want Lawful Access to All Your Encrypted Data." I mean, the whole point of data being encrypted is to keep people out. And when you start creating backdoors, as we've seen with Salt Typhoon and the whole cellular network debacle, a big time here in the U.S. because of these SS7 backdoor accesses that were put there many years ago, I think that post-Patriot Act, We've seen how that's turned out. Basically, nation-state hackers have been chilling, hanging out, having beers, smoking weed in our cellular networks, basically for how long we don't know. If they're out, we don't know. And what all they got and were able to consume, whether it was text messages, phone calls, call logs, things of that nature, data flows. I don't know. I haven't seen any reports on that, but republished on February 24th further responses to Apple's move and implications for what happens next in the U.S. This is the Apple removed full iCloud security for UK users. So it may feel a long way from Americans users this weekend, but it's not, says the article writer. Far from it. What has just shocked the UK is exactly what the FBI told me it also wants in the US. Quote, lawful access to any encrypted user data. The Bureau's quiet warning was confirmed just a few weeks ago. The UK news cannot be seen in isolation and follows years of battling between big tech and governments over warranted legal access to encrypted messages and content to fuel investigations into serious crimes such as terrorism and child abuse. I've said it not ad nauseum in multiple episodes. Every time you hear terrorism or child abuse, it should immediately trigger a flag in your brain. Like, well, you know that meme? Oh, here we go. From Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when Leonardo DiCaprio is watching TV, you know, he's kind of does the whistle and the points to the TV screen. That's kind of how I feel, is that meme. Like, oh, here we go. You know, terrorism and child abuse. And he says, as I reported in 2020, it is looking ever more likely that proponents of end-to-end security, the likes of Facebook and Apple, will lose their campaign to maintain user security as a priority. It has taken 5 years, but here we are. It says the last few weeks have been seen to a signal a unique fork in the road between the U.S. and its primary Five Eyes ally, the U.K., but it isn't. In December, the FBI and CISA warned Americans to stop sending texts and use encrypted platforms instead. And now the U.K. has forced open iCloud to open iCloud by threatening to mandate a backdoor. But the devil's in the detail, and we're fast approaching a dangerous pivot. It says, while CISA, the America's Cyber Defense Agency, appears to advocate for a fully secure messaging platforms such as Signal, the FBI's views appear to be different. When December's encryption warnings hit the wake of Salt Typhoon, the Bureau told me, this is the journalist, while it wants to see encrypted messaging, it wants the encryption to be responsible. I don't know what that means, because encryption is math, so I don't know how you ask math to be responsible. What they're asking for is that the companies who are hosting the technologies to be compliant. That's what I'm reading right there. What that means in practice, the FBI said, is that while law enforcement supports strong, responsibly managed encryption, whatever the hell that means, this encryption should be designed to protect people's privacy and also managed so U.S. tech companies can provide readable content in response to lawful court orders. Well, that's what just happened in the UK, and Apple's iCloud remains encrypted, but Apple holds the keys and can facilitate readable content in response to a lawful court order. So there are three primary providers of end-to-end encrypted messaging in the US and the UK. So it's Apple, Google, and Meta. Those are the big ones, right? So that's kind of where they're starting first. It says the UK has just pushed Apple to compromise iMessage, and it is more likely that the secret discussions are also ongoing with the other two, meaning Google and Meta. It makes no sense to single out Apple, as they would simply push bad actors to other platforms, which will happen anyway, as it's obvious to any like security professional. So in doing this, the UK has changed the art of the possible bringing new, you know, optionally to new security agencies across the world, right? So this is kind of like opening up a whole new possibility, because once you have a precedent, especially in a westernized country like the United States or Canada or UK or any of the EU countries, you start Australia, New Zealand, you start seeing, oh, the countries start going like, oh, this is possible. Like, we can do this. I mean, this is a law that they passed almost like 9 years ago, and now they're kind of flexing it. Now it's time to start flexing that. So the UK actually has had this law. Other countries could pass laws like this, in which case, if Apple or Google or Meta wants to operate in those countries, they will have to find a way to provide access to even what the company says is end-to-end encrypted. So, okay. This also tells me another thing, side note, is that yet it seems that Apple truly is end-to-end encrypting data when you enable it, when you opt in. There are privacy influencers, big ones, who are getting a lot of screen time, who spout a lot of information about Google and Apple and Meta as these big Skynet operators. And yes, to a degree, I think a lot of that is true. These are not great companies. These are companies I actively try to go out of my way to avoid participating in. However, when I hear influencers say, well, Apple's doing on-device scanning and you know, reporting all your stuff and sending all your stuff to, you know, three-letter agencies, and they have all this access to it, it's kind of like, well, no. If they did, this wouldn't be such a big deal. If they already had all this access, because UK, again, like I mentioned earlier, is a Five Eyes country. So if the US had already had carte blanche access to everything within within Apple's ecosystem as far as data on its users, it wouldn't have to go through all this trouble. Like, this kind of shows me, like, at least Apple is probably actually doing what they're saying they're doing. When you enable advanced data protection, what Apple is saying is, we no longer have a key to unlock your data. This includes iCloud backups, messages. There's a lot of stuff that's already encrypted by default with their standard encryption, but this takes it another level and encrypts, I think, like 27 or 29 different services, with the exception of contacts, calendar, and email, because those are just by design very difficult to do end-to-end encryption because they are old protocols, and it would probably break the functionality. So this is like all your health data. This is your iMessage. This is your photos, your maps data. Everything is end-to-end encrypted, and you are the only one that has the key to unlock your data, which is why you have to set up a key holder, a backup key holder, where not that they're a holder, but they can be sent a link to help you get back in your iCloud account if you forget your iCloud password. Because what Apple's saying is, if you lose your password, you better have some good designated contacts that can help you recover your account, because if you don't, we can't help you. That tells me that it is truly end-to-end encrypted, that your iCloud account, email address, and password in 2FA are the keys to unlocking your data, and you alone only can unlock it, which is good. It's a good thing. But at the same time, governments are trying to break this and get in and push. So if they're doing it to Apple, they're definitely doing it to Google. They're definitely doing it to Meta, especially with like WhatsApp being one of the biggest messaging apps used globally. Next would be maybe iMessage, maybe Facebook Messenger, things like of that nature. So this is really important to follow. This is really important to understand, because this is coming to America. This is coming to a theater near you. So start building your action plan if you don't have one already. And what I mean by that is, if you're anything like me, right, there are some things that you have a certain level of acceptability for because of convenience, because of your spouse or your kids, your family members. You say, well, I wish I could delete this, but I still have this because this is how I communicate with this person. And it might be iMessage. It might be Facebook Messenger on your phone. It might be something else. Well, the governments are, this is the FBI telling us, this is the UK telling us, two countries, part of Five Eyes, who are saying, we want to access all your stuff. We want lawful access is what they're saying, but really what they're saying is, we just want access to your stuff. And this is the wake-up call. Maybe that's the episode title name. This is the wake-up call. that you've been waiting for that says, well, I'll get to that eventually when it becomes more imminent that I need to pay attention to my setup, right? Your technology stack, if you will, your phone, your computer, where you're storing your data, what applications you're using to communicate. It's becoming more important now than ever to start working on that plan, because you wake up one morning and it's all of a sudden there's a switch, and now all of your private data, right, your precious information, now potentially exposed for the sole purpose of finding terrorists and child abusers. And what's crazy is that with all of this money they spend, all this control and all this surveillance, I don't ever see headlines of catching terrorists. I see more headlines about taking down darknet markets and hackers and breach forums and things of that nature, which, you know, I mean, okay, you're doing some police work. But I mean, especially in the United States, any news website you go to right now, all they want to do is talk about politics, which tells me that there must not be a whole lot of terrorists being caught and or child abusers, at least not from these dragnet surveillance plants, because that's not really what it's about at all. It's about wanting to know everything about everyone at all times. Even when you have UK is like one of the biggest, I think, if not one of the biggest video surveilled. I mean, I don't know compared to like, say, South Korea or something, because I know there's heavy video surveillance. But in the UK, I know it's got a ton of video surveillance. And how much crime does it stop? Not much. There's a lot of crime. It's not preventing the crime. Does it maybe help in some investigations and things of that nature? Yes. After the freaking crime has already happened, though, they're not stopping the crime, is my point. So all these people give up all this privacy and liberty, right? Maybe that camera's pointed in a corner in your backyard is in that corner. So if your wife is out sunbathing or you want a skinny dip in your hot tub, are you on in that surveillance camera? And you say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, but do you want whoever has the ability to watch that, record that, store it, share it? Do you want them to have those kinds of capabilities? Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about your memories. You're talking about your when you were dating, or if you are dating and you're sending all the hot and steamy photos to each other. And we're talking about all that stuff, right? We're talking about all the memes, and we're talking about all the conversations that you think are private that you wouldn't say in public, because that's public. You're saying this in private with one person or a group chat. Do you want all of that exposed? Do you want all of that in the open? You're not doing anything wrong, though, right? Like, think about it. I know a large percentage of my audience is male. A big, I think it's somewhere around 64%. So we're going to say heavy percentage. Come on, you guys got some group chats. I know you do. I've got some of them with you. Some of you guys who are listening right now, I've got group chats with you. And we drop some dank memes on each other. And, you know, it's like, think about all that stuff, right? Do you want that just out in the open and surveilled? Like, because they're trying to catch the terrorists. They're trying to catch the child abusers. So we got to look at your memes. We got to look at all your steamy, pics and all that stuff. No, absolutely not. So, I'm not going to read all of these articles, but I really wanted to spend some time on this because this kind of dovetails into what Google's doing with machine learning to estimate a user's age. So Google says that the technology will help provide age-appropriate experiences. Again, going back to the more we know, the more we can cater to you know, what you can see and this kind of thing. So Google will soon use machine learning. And this is, just for context, this is a Verge article that came out on February 12th. Again, all the links are in the show notes. So Google will soon use machine learning to estimate the age of its users. So in an update on Wednesday, this is going back about 2 weeks, Google said it's testing machine learning model in the U.S. to help determine whether someone is under 18. Allowing it to provide more age-appropriate experiences across its platforms. So YouTube CEO Neil Mohan, I always say his name wrong, Mohan, I think, first revealed the change in an annual letter published on Tuesday. The age estimation model will use existing data about users, including the sites they visit, what kind of videos they watch on YouTube. So for you anime lovers, you know, you might get dinged by this, and how long they've had an account to determine their age. When it detects a user may be under 18, Google will notify the team that it has changed some of their settings and will offer information about the users that can verify their age with a selfie, credit card, or government ID. Google will apply its existing safety features to underage accounts, including its safe search filter that helps remove explicit content from search results, which that in itself is a good thing. It's good to have safeguards. It's good to have search filtering, right? But this should be done by the parents. And I know a lot of you, go rolling your eyes, Simon, like, whatever, dude, like, you know, parents don't care. Well, that's their problem. Don't punish the rest of the world and force them to upload pictures of their ID and credit cards to prove they're over 18 so they can view the site. That's ridiculous. So, you know, basically what they're saying is it will also restrict content on YouTube that might not be appropriate for users under 18, which, granted, I mean, there's a lot of stuff on YouTube, but a lot of it gets flagged and removed before it's really up there long enough. I don't really know. I mean, we're not talking live leak here, okay? This is YouTube. So what information, what videos are on there that are not appropriate for a 16-year-old watch that a 22-year-old could watch? I'm curious, too. Google plans to bring its age estimation technology to more countries over time. So it's starting in the U.S., and I guess they're going to be rolling it out in other countries. It says, we will continue to explore additional opportunities to provide increased transparency to users about age estimation at the account level. Google spokesperson Matt Bryant said in a statement to The Verge, the change likely comes in response to the heightened attention surrounding online child safety in the U.S., in addition to the Kids Online Safety Act, BOOM, and COPPA 2.0. Tech giants are contending with Kids Off Social Media Act, KOSMA, which aims to prevent kids under 13 from accessing social media. That's COSMA, the Kids Off Social Media Act. Getting them off is the whole point of that. COSMA proposes having online platforms guess users' age through this form of age verification. It isn't always accurate, it says. Meta has also started using AI to scan for signals that a user might be under 18. So AI is probably going to be a big part of that for sure, because it can basically understand context, or at least basically maybe like what reading comprehension you're at, or by your writing abilities. But again, now it's scanning. It's going to be looking at more. It's tracking more. Then it's going to ask you to verify who you are by asking for your ID or your credit card information to run a transaction, though, which doxes you. Yes, some of you are listening going, well, I'll just use a privacy.com card. I'll just use it. Yeah, that may or may not work. We know in the past using voice over IP services or using cloaked debit card numbers that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So Google's pretty good at detecting whether or not something is basically being cloaked or not. So that may not even work to be able to use a privacy.com card or a MySudo card or cloaked card or a prepaid Visa gift card from the gas station. So all of this is to say, right, is that these things are moving pretty quickly as far as some of it's actually already happening, like advanced data protection being removed for UK citizens. We're seeing Google wanting to use machine learning, which is a fancy way of saying artificial intelligence to a degree, to detect patterns. So they require more surveillance on what you're doing to then also determine whether or not they need to see ID to use what's supposed to be a free and open web. And the way that I am trying to exercise my own dissidence is to not use as much of this as possible, which basically means you have to find solutions or alternatives. And sometimes they're not great, right? Sometimes they're kind of abysmal in some cases, whether it's open source applications or a workflow or an app or something that you're used to using. If you say, I'm not going to use this anymore, it does sometimes make your life way more inconvenient. But it does make you more sovereign, and it does take you out of the selection pool for being chosen to KYC yourself just to visit a website. You're not conducting a financial transaction. You're just surfing the web, reading news, consuming video content, reading blogs, things of that nature. And now with social media, with these different pushes for social media to have age verification, where a lot of, probably most content is consumed, right, on applications like Instagram and TikTok, YouTube, things of that nature. There's probably a large majority of traffic there. Now, I know a lot of people listening will say, well, no, I use, you know, Lemmy, or I don't use Reddit, I use Lemmy, or you're the small minority, right? And that's the reason why I think it's important to connect with like-minded individuals. We don't have to be aligned in a lot of other things to find commonalities and help each other. You may be, you know, right, I might be left, you might be center, I might be gay, you might be straight. It doesn't really matter, right? None of that stuff matters, because we can all come together and say, hey, this is wrong and this is effed up, and what can I do about it, right? That's the whole point of me doing this podcast. I made a joke on the last episode, which was really because I had no friends other than the hated one. And I wanted to make friends who kind of had a passion for understanding how to protect myself and us as individuals from all of these just grotesque laws and gross violations of our rights and of our privacy. And we don't have to, you know, you don't have to be a weirdo to feel that way. And I feel like for the longest time, people who I call normies would kind of be like, well, that's just weird. You're just weird for thinking like that, right? Like, because you care about this, because you care about who is spying and who's monetizing you. It's not so weird. I mean, and to the point where even Apple sees the value in making that part of their core of their marketing focus is this, you know, Apple, that's privacy or whatever the hell with the paddle lock, you know. So it's definitely getting more popular to pay attention and be more secure. It seems more common now. I hear more people using Proton Mail. It used to be if you gave someone a Proton Mail address, they'd say, huh? Crouton? What did you say? Yeah, Proton Mail. Remember back when you first signed up with Proton Mail and all the email domains ended with like a .ch? It was like, email me Simon at protonmail.ch. People are like looking at you like you're a freak. And now I actually regularly, not because of the circles that I'm in, just in the real world, that I hear more Proton Mail addresses. Like, it's kind of more normal. It's kind of cool. I don't hear Tutamail or any other ones, but Proton Mail is probably one of the more popular, obviously, ones. So that's kind of cool. If you're a weirdo, feel welcome. That's what I'm saying. So I wanted to kind of, I don't think I'm going to get to a lot of this stuff. I want to touch on this MolVat thing. So MolVat put out a press release on February 11th. MolVat is a VPN maker, and they also make a browser. And I like MolVat. I've been using them quite a long time. This is not a endorsement. It's just, hey, I like them, and they take Monero for payment. So booyah. You could literally go to any, I would say, if you're going to set up an account, go do it from your home, but go somewhere else, set up the account. And when I say set up the account, you don't actually create like an account in a traditional sense with like an email address and password. They generate an account number for you, and you just keep that. And then you can top up your service, whatever interval you want. I usually pay for, you know, usually 6 months or a year at a time, but you can pay with different ways that will keep your identity anonymous. You can send cash in the mail, which is pretty dope. You can pay by a credit card if you want to, sure. Maybe use a masked credit card. I've never actually used that to pay for it, but I'm sure you could and work fine. I use Monero. You also get a 10% discount, which is cool if you pay with Monero. And then basically, you know, you can use that account to now I know what you're thinking. Oh, they're going to have logs of your home, you know, IP if you connect from there and things of that nature. True. That's a very good point. So I think that's one of the reasons why they partnered with Obscura VPN, because they say, on February 11th. Today, we are announcing a partnership with Obscura VPN, a newly launched two-party VPN service that uses our WireGuard VPN servers as its exit hop. So it says this partnership starts on February 11th, 2025, with apps for macOS being available from this date on Obscura VPN's website. While connected through Obscura, your traffic first passes through Obscura's servers before exiting to the internet via Mulvad's WireGuard servers. This two-party architecture ensures that neither Obscura nor Mulvad can see both your identity and your internet traffic. So Obscura users can verify that their traffic is sent encrypted to a Mulvad server by comparing their server's WireGuard public key, shown on the Obscura's apps like location page, against those published on our server page. So Obscura also features our server page being Mulvad. Obscura also features a custom obfuscation protocol based on QUIC that mimics HTTP3 traffic to bypass firewalls and censorship. So kind of like just a proxy. It says this service is separate from Mulvad VPN, and there is a link to Obscura's website, and there's also a website to view on Tor as well. So they provide the Onion link. This link will be in the show notes. I'm trying to be optimistic. I think that's kind of cool. It looks like a strategic. And then this is a partnership. This is not an acquisition. So this is something to do with two separate companies, two separate entities that are basically utilizing each other's services to benefit the users that they each individually have. So I haven't tried it yet. This has obviously just come out in the last couple of weeks, and it apparently is only initially available to Mac OS users through Obscura. But it's an interesting concept that I think more of these products and solutions we could all benefit from, as long as they're, you know, semi-legit. Like, you basically, there's always some trust involved anytime you're using someone else's server to establish a connection, store data on, whether that's email or files or anything like that. So there's always a level of trust. It's just a matter of which ones do you trust more than the rest. I tend to really lean more towards Mulvad VPN or ivpn.net. Sure, Proton VPN I think is fine as well. I just like, because I use Proton for email, I don't like to use their VPN. I like to separate, compartmentalize network traffic from service providers. Doesn't mean you have to. It's just something that I've done for a long time, and it's just a habit I formed. Because I'll give you a prime example. Today, I have not been able to log into, or I don't really log in. I haven't been able to access two of my Lavabit email accounts. And also, let me check actually their website. It seems that their website has been down all day as well. And I'm trying to load their website right now and see if it'll load in the background. Yeah, it's not loading. So this is a lesson learned it says unable to connect to their website. It's still offline. Their DNS records are nuked. So if you use Lavabit, maybe send me a message. Let me know if you're also having problems. I assume you are, being that their DNS records are totally gone. Lavabit is a longtime privacy-focused email provider that was hosting Edward Snowden's email. And when they came and knocked on their door to get the keys to unlock it, they shut their business down. They reopened, I think in like 2016 or so, they reopened, reestablished Lavabit. I've been a Lavabit user for like maybe 5 or 6 years. I don't have any terribly important accounts tied to it. Fortunately, I keep track of all that stuff, and it's easy to do with a password manager. You know, you just go into your password managers. I use a couple and just do a quick search for those emails and making sure, like, okay, these are the accounts I had tied to them. I might need a different way to recover access to those if I need to. Let this be a lesson learned, though, right? This is why I like to compartmentalize. If I have all my eggs in one basket, and that basket goes down or is compromised or in any way, I want it to be as less impactful to me as possible. So I use multiple email providers. In this case, this kind of sucks because I was also using LavaBit email addresses and I'm not using custom domains or anything. So I was actually talking about having a conversation with this earlier with the hated one, telling him like, bro, I can't access my LavaBit accounts. You know what's going on? And, you know, he's like, dude, he's like, you know, even if you have your own domain, it's, you don't truly own it. And I agree. He's absolutely right. I mean, anything could theoretically be taken, but it's a lot easier if you are in control of your domains, right? So your email address at yourdomain.com, to be able to move those somewhere else, like, you know, you should be keeping a copy of your email, obviously, when you download it. But if something happens to your email service provider, like let's say ProtonMail, well, if you're using a custom domain name, then you could go to a different email provider because you can just change the MX records and the DMARC records for your domain and point your email to another server. If you're reliant on ProtonMail.com, email addresses and things of that nature, well, what happens if ProtonMail gets taken down for whatever reason? Do you lose your email? I'm in that situation right now. I'm looking at a unavailable to connect page trying to go to LavaBit.com. I don't know. Maybe they're being DDoSed. Maybe the feds are kicking in their doors earlier today. I have no idea. They're not answering to me on X. I've reached out to people on Noster. It seems like I'm the only LavaBit user because no one's talking about it. So I don't know. But anyway, that's why. That's why I don't. Perfect example. Real world, real life situation that happened to me today on why I don't put all my eggs with one service provider. So long story is, check them out. You know, check out maybe this obscure VPN service partnered with Mulvad VPN. Maybe it adds additional layers depending upon your threat model. Maybe that seems too excessive. Also, I'm testing. I just installed someone in our chat. Let me give them a credit. Who was I talking to earlier? Fresh Veracity? Is that who I was talking to? Yeah, Fresh Veracity. Is having issues with their Mulvad VPN client on GrapheneOS and running the beta version because it has the multi-hop option, which has been available in the iOS version for quite a while. But now it's finally in the Android version. So I installed it, went over 5G, and it was working well for me. So Mulvad, for those that don't understand multi-hop, that's where you can specify your entry server that you want to connect to. So let's say, you know, you want to connect to a server in Canada, and then you want your exit to be somewhere in Europe. So basically it kind of just breaks the chain. It's harder to fingerprint sometimes, you know, when you have basically different servers you're connecting to. And it's almost kind of like Tor. Tor works on a three relay circuit. So you have an entry, a relay, and an exit. So, you know, I think a lot of these service providers are trying to mimic, and I'm not a Tor expert, so if I didn't use the right terminology, I apologize. But essentially what happens is when you use the Tor network, you basically have three different connections, three hops, and there's a different layer of encryption on your network traffic, and it kind of, you know, basically separates the where the request originated from the exit node. So it has no idea where you are because all it saw was what it got from the relay. So that's kind of how these multi-hops work to a degree, right? It's not as probably as secure as Tor. I'm not saying that it is. I'm just trying to paint an analogy or paint some contrast here. And I think that maybe is kind of what Mulvad and Obscura are trying to do. There's a company, this wasn't part of my show notes, there's a company I've been trying to do some research on called NIM, NYM.com. Actually, the hated one and I were kind of doing some research on them. This is a company that was started by Chelsea Manning and got some funding in the last couple of years. I'm just not a fan at all of technology stacks that are tokenized or have tokenomics that have cryptocurrency connected to it. And that is what this kind of is. And it's basically what I gleaned from, I didn't read the white paper. I just kind of gleaned the white paper is that they're trying to build a Tor-like service that's decentralized. I think that's probably where the tokenomics comes in, is because it will rely on users to operate likely servers to participate in making this work, but kind of like running Tor on the clear net. And I don't really know a whole lot about it. It seemed kind of suspicious to me. all the people involved. If you know anything about NIM.com, I would love to get some information about that. So it was kind of more of a side thing, but it was on topic with this. And it's just something I was researching a few days ago going like, what is this all about? This NIM.com, it's NIM VPN thing. So I don't think they're live yet. I'm just going to keep it on my radar, but I also feel like it's kind of like almost too sus, you know, it's just too glowy for me to just get all excited about it, right? So I'm going to remain neutral on these things until I have some time to process and experiment and try them out. So I wanted to just touch on this. Microsoft is offering free ad-supported Office, and they're calling it just a test. This is if you've messed around with Office, Microsoft Office, free Office web app, you've likely discovered that it stinks. For one important reason, you can't actually create documents. A new free ad-supported local version of Office changes all that, according to a report. There's been an update. The ad-supported version as a test, a Microsoft representative said Monday. This is a PC World article, and it was dated from yesterday, February 24th. Apparently, there was an update to the article because Microsoft probably saw it and said, hey, this is just a test. We're just testing it out. Currently, there's no plans to launch a free ad-supported version of Microsoft Office desktop apps. Well, of course, right? Of course you're not. Why would you be testing it if you weren't planning on rolling it out? And that's the thing I hate. I hate ads in general. And I get that, you know, ads pay a lot of bills for things. But I hate when ads are baked into the operating system. Like, I don't often get on a Windows computer, but when I do and I click the start button and there's like weather and articles and news stuff popping up within the OS, not like just a web page, but the operating system, I'm completely skeeved out. Like, what is all this injected malware on this machine? It seems like Apple does want to do that. They're actually, I think, planning to roll ads out into their Apple Maps, kind of like how Waze does or something like that. But Microsoft seems to maybe be trying and testing, hey, if we gave you Office for free or a watered down version of it for free, would you use it if we have banner ads on the side? I'm sure some people would, but no, thank you. No, thank you at all, which because anything that has ads baked into it is also going to have tracking built into it to see what ads you click on, what ads you prefer, like what gets your attention, what takes your attention away from the middle of the screen from what you're working on typing, and a different ad pops up and you pause and you stop typing and you're looking at the ad, like it knows that stuff. And so opt out of all that crap. So I'm going to have a link here. I'm not going to read the whole article to you because really I think it's kind of stupid. But this is a thing, right? The whole thing is companies have continually got to increase their bottom line, their profits. If they're not selling more hardware or software solutions, or getting more subscribers to whatever they're providing, then they have to find other ways to monetize your attention. So that's where ads come in. And Apple does it. Google does it, obviously. Microsoft does it. And it's just like, is this going to get worse? It's the we always talk about, and we joke about it in the Matrix chat, the total shitification of the internet, because it's just like, it just gets in and ruins your everything. Like, you can sit down and have like a certain mindset about your day, and then you're getting these things injected into your system to compete for your attention, to take you off task. It creates anxiety, can create depression, because now you're like low-key yearning for some product that you didn't even know about 30 seconds ago that now you think you can't live without. That t-shirt, that hat, those pair of shoes, that bag, whatever, the thing, widget, the object. You weren't even thinking about it. And now, in 10 seconds, you can't live without it. And you're actually considering putting it in the cart, right? Instagram is notorious at this. So that's why it's good to block all that stuff out to begin with, not to mention save yourself the bandwidth and the tracking. So there are some other stuff. I'm not going to get to all of it because I want to talk about a few things and I wanted to get to my plan. So there's some Grubhub data breach. There was who was behind the seized forums of cracked and nulled spyware makers. Paragon Arc confirmed that U.S. government is a customer. That's an interesting one. I might circle the wagons on in another episode. Oh, there's a great piece on this one article written by this blog, tim.sh, everyone knows your location, tracking myself through in-app ads. And it's this blog post, and this guy does this brilliant job of breaking down and analyzing his web traffic and even creates a data flow of how he got from his phone to the location, even if you were saying ASCAP not to track and all this other crap. So the TLDR, the too long didn't read, which is just a summary on this, on his blog post, and definitely go check it out because I found it very interesting. It says, after more than a couple dozen hours of trying, here are the main takeaways. One, he says, I found a couple requests sent from my phone with my location. By the way, if you go read the article, he'll tell you he used like a completely new iCloud account. He set everything up as if it was brand new. So he didn't have existing data on the phone that would have given something away. So he says, he goes, I found a couple requests sent by my phone with my location, plus five requests that leak my IP address, which can be turned into geolocation using reverse DNS. Two, learned a lot about the RTB, the real-time bidding, auctions, and OpenRTB protocol, and was shocked by the amount and types of data sent with the bids to ad exchanges. Three, gave up on the idea to buy my location data from the data broker or a tracking service because I don't have big enough company to take a a trial run of $10,000 to $50,000 to buy a huge database with the data of millions of people plus me. He says, well, maybe I do, but such expense seems a little irrational. So it turns out the EU based people's data is almost this, just as expensive, but still I know my location data was collected and I know where to buy it. So that's the too long didn't read of this article. Basically goes through and shows by opening up, I think he's using an app called Charles. Basically, it's a sniffer that shows all the connections that are being made through different services that are running on the phone, as well as apps. And even on apps that you specify do not track, they're still able to track. Matter of fact, when I looked at the data flow, they almost looked exactly the same. And the real-time auction bidding thing is pretty wild. If you ever get a hair to go down a rabbit hole, there's some interesting videos on YouTube. You can just search up, how does real-time bidding work? And there's some great videos talking about how all these, there's companies like Cox Media and tons of them out there that basically make tons of money by running real-time auction bidding for ads, for publishers, so for advertisers. So it's a real thing, and they can get very, very accurate. Not even if you're giving location access through your app, it can do it through reverse engineering based on your identifiers, your device ID, your advertising IDs on the device. It can also be reverse engineered by using your IP address. Most of the time, IP addresses give a relatively accurate geolocation. Sometimes they'll give very accurate locations depending upon what service provider you're using at the time. But yeah, it's kind of a fascinating article. It's kind of a little nerdy, but really cool. So he kind of breaks down looking at, Facebook, how that tracking was done, even things like screen brightness levels that was being sent back, all the IVF and advertising tracking ID, everything. And it was just like, wow, dude, this is crazy. So yeah, check it out. It'll be in the show notes. I just want to kind of just glean on a couple things that I'm working on right now and how I'm trying to move to a more self-hosted life. And I want to kind of, I'm going to kind of theme these out. I have this structure in the bottom of my show notes that if you go to the show notes, it won't really look like very actionable, but this is kind of where my mind is right now. Because I talk about self-hosting, and one of my favorite pieces of software that I've been running for four-ish years or so, I'd say probably four, maybe 5 years, is Nextcloud. So Next, I used to run OwnCloud way back in the day. There was actually an open source project called Open Groupware, I think, or Open Groupwise, something like that, that I ran. I'm going back to 2005, 2006. where I first started trying to have a hand at this self-hosting for a personal cloud, even before we really called it that. I had started a company back then, which was very focused around Linux and using open source technology to build networks and servers and things. I had rented servers through Server Beach and Rackspace. So and that business eventually foiled into a different business and then eventually went out of business and I went into consulting. But anyways, Nextcloud, the reason I bring that up is like there's a lot of history for me with with trying to do those things. I feel at home like running Nextcloud. So Nextcloud is an open source software stack that basically you can run inside your home, inside your business. You can set it up in the cloud. You can also pay to have it hosted. It can be end-to-end encrypted. It's your own cloud storage. And I have been experimenting with different ways of running that in the last few years with running it on Start OS, which is a Start9 server OS that I purchased. You can also run other services on there, but Nextcloud is one of them. You can also run it on Umbral and Casa OS. These are probably kind of like easier solutions. Like I'd say Start9, Umbral, and Casa OS are kind of like the very easy ways to get into it, where you could just install it really simply. Once it's installed, you just open up a web browser, go to the IP address and the port. You could create an admin account. You can set up some users. The other cool thing about Nextcloud that no one ever really talks about is you can easily attach third-party cloud buckets and attach them to user profile accounts as basically folders. So let's say you're running a Raspberry Pi, right? I love Raspberry Pis, but I wouldn't like run a production Nextcloud server on Raspberry Pi. But if you just want to play around with it, you have an old laptop, you have a Raspberry Pi, something laying around, try installing Ubuntu Linux on it and then install Casa OS, or maybe just download the Umbral ISO and install that. But basically, you can also install it via Docker very easily if you're comfortable with Docker. Docker's maybe a little bit more, takes a little bit more time, but you can run a Nextcloud server, and if you have a very small hard drive, let's say you only have a 1 terabyte drive in that old laptop, or maybe a half a terabyte, maybe it's only 512 gigabytes on that old laptop sitting on a shelf. What you can do is you can install Linux or Docker or put Umbral on it or Casa OS. These are real easy, and there's amazing YouTube guides. I've put them in the show notes in the past. You can just go to YouTube, go to Google, and just go to your start page, go to your DuckDuckGo, whatever you like to use. And you say, how do I set up Casa OS or Nextcloud on Umbral or Nextcloud in Docker? You can set it up on this laptop. Here's the cool thing about this. You can use Cryptomator. So you can actually attach very cheaply like an S3 bucket to your Nextcloud and then attach that to your user profile. So what you can do is on your computer, you can install Cryptomator and create a vault, and it's mapped to that folder, right? So it's kind of like using your own Nextcloud, using Cryptomator to also your own S3 bucket, right? And you can encrypt your data very cheaply. The reason why I'm bringing that up is it's actually something I've been experimenting with. It's been working very well if you don't have a ton of hard drive space, right? Like, so if you're like, oh, I don't want to back up like my 5 terabytes of photos, I'm going to have to build this crazy Nextcloud. Well, you could, but if it's just photos, like just attach an S3 bucket to it. It's going to cost you a few bucks a month. Use Cryptomator to create a vault on it. And then put all your photos in there. And now they're end-to-end encrypted and you're using cheap cloud storage. And if your Nextcloud server ever dies, like all that data is still there because you could spin up another Nextcloud server literally anywhere, reattach the bucket, and you kind of see where I'm going. You get a lot of flexibility. Now, the ideal scenario would be if you have a lot of hard drive space, set it up in your home lab. But you also need to make sure you have a backup solution for that. So before you kind of go full hog and saying like, cool, I got my Nextcloud server, I'm going to use this for my primary cloud, and then something happens, the basement floods, power outage, glitch, something weird happens, right? And now your data's gone, you got to have a backup. So I like having multiple Nextcloud servers. One of them is a backup solution to the other. But also I've been experimenting with using very cheap DigitalOcean S3 buckets, right? I think it's DigitalOcean. Yeah, or Linode. Yeah, no, I use both, but I think I'm specifically using the ones through DigitalOcean. Basically, it's easy. You have a server that you specify. You have an API key, a secret key, and you know that it's really not hard. There's some great tutorials. Actually, I might do a tutorial on this because I don't know if there is a tutorial. I've kind of just stumbled upon it through some various articles on how to. So anyway, I'm also wanting to do some YouTube content, so I'm going to try that out. And if you all hate it, then I'm just going to stop. But running your own Nextcloud server allows you to have things like your contacts backed up and your documents and your photos and all these different things. And if you want photos to be viewable like they are, like kind of pretty and like Apple Photos and things, there's also other solutions you can install through Casa OS or Umbral that will allow you to do that. Photo management applications so that you can share them with your friends or family. Also, I always recommend having a backup. I personally use Enti, E-N-T-E. Is a photo backup from my phones. Yes, I back them up to Nextcloud. They're on the phone, but I do a lot in media. There's a lot of times I'm taking photos of things that oftentimes are basically for composition and other stuff. So I'll spend the $10 a month to back them up again using an end-to-end encrypted service like Enti. I think it's Enti.io, and do that. So there's the thing. You're going to have to get used to the idea of like not everything's free. You're going to have to pay for some stuff. You're going to have to create some stuff. You're going to have to learn some things. But I tell you, it's worth it. If you're willing to go down this path, it will absolutely be worth it. Then you can also set up a network attached storage, right? I currently have a couple different solutions for backing up stuff for my company. I use a Unified NAS Pro, and I'm also using some other direct attached storage solutions. But I'm also planning on building out. I'm gonna try using TrueNAS, another NAS, and kind of get familiar with using that and side by side. But Synology is a common one, QNAP. There's quite a few out there now. These are just solutions you can buy right off the shelf. And actually, a lot of people use Synology in our chat. And basically what a Synology is, it's just a box. It's a computer. They start from a few $100. They go up to several thousand, depending upon how big of a storage you want. And the cool thing is you can run Nextcloud on that. You can run your network shares on that. You could run Nextcloud on there. All in a box. These are low power machines too, so they're not going to be running up your electric bill or anything. They have the ability to connect from outside your home network. I think they use some magic, kind of like Unify does, but you could also set up things like Tailscale or a Cloudflare tunnel and make it easy to access, especially if you're providing access to other friends or family outside of your home network. So don't open ports, never open ports. Always do some sort of reverse DNS or a proxy or a tunnel of some kind to access your data. But these are the things that I'm working on right now. Also setting up own tracks for basically kind of like a open source Find My solution. So if you have kids or whatever and you want to keep track of where everybody is, but host it yourself. DNS and ad blocking filtering, right? Things like Pi-hole, AdGuard. Now, these are things I already have set up. I'm just kind of throwing them out there as ideas. What those things can do is basically on a Raspberry Pi, you could run, it could also be in a virtual machine. I'm going to get to that in a second, but you could run open source software like Pi-hole or AdGuard. You basically tell your modem or your gateway to point to that device as your internal DNS server, and that server will filter out all the ads and block all the tracking at the network level. So a lot of times, you know, we're all trying to like install these browser extensions like uBlock Origin or Privacy Badger or whatever your favorite go-to is, right? And your Firefox or, you know, whatever browser, Brave, whatever you're using. Well, you can block a lot of that right at the network level. And things like Pi-hole and AdGuard, there's a couple other solutions out there will just stop it. All the tracking, all the cookie tracking and everything right at the firewall or the at DNS, at the DNS level. So those are great projects. Another thing I'm working on is how I want to do some self-hosted RSS management. Because I talked about earlier about wanting to run my own like ground news kind of service for myself. And I'm planning to do that with RSS. So I have kind of like this hogposh. Is that a word? Hogposh? Hogwash? Hogposh? Mishmash? I don't know. It's a convoluted way of tracking my RSS through OPML files that I just keep moving around from different tool to tool, but I'd love to have something that's accessible from all my devices. So I'm looking at setting that up for basically a service approach rather than an app approach. Well, I've been using like Newsflash on GNOME and macOS, right? And I kind of just send my OPML file every time I add new art. It's so stupid. But I then I'm like, oh, I'm on my phone. I'm like, where's my RSS? Oh, it's on my laptop. It's kind of a pain in the ass. So those don't know what I'm talking about. RSS is just a syndication service, right? Where you can basically have all the places you like to read your news aggregate into one place and organized by topic or category. So if some news site publishes a new article, it automatically updates in your RSS reader of choice. There's tons of apps, tons of solutions to do this, but I want to run an RSS service. So my whole point is all these things that I want to do require more servers. So I think, and not only what I think, what I'm going to do is I've started doing research. Of course, I've been tapping people like Unintelligent7 and Mattis Max, like, hey guys, I want to set up a Proxmox server and I want to do it right and I want it to scale. So Proxmox is basically a way to set up virtual servers and on one, having one beefy system, you know, and build out all my servers inside there. And you can run everything I'm talking about, Nextcloud, RSS, torrent monitoring, home automation stuff. I mean, whatever you don't forget about the media stuff. I have a separate dedicated server just for Jellyfin and Plex with like 30 some odd, I don't know how many terabytes are on there. A lot. I could move all of that. I'll probably keep that separate, but I could move all of this stuff into like one or two clusters or Proxmox environments. I can maybe do a cluster. That's what Unintelligent7 told me to do. So I'm going to say the word cluster, and it makes me sound really smart. Though I know how to kind of set up the Proxmox server, I don't know how to set up the cluster stuff yet, but that's kind of where I'm going, right? And I kind of want to encourage you wherever you are in any of this, and I might be saying stuff, and you're like, Simon, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. That's okay. If there's anything, I just want to get the message across of like the reason why I talk about all these articles and these stories is to emphasize that like things are changing. They're changing quickly. Some of this stuff takes a while to learn, right? And if you really want to put the time and effort into it, it will pay off. And I'm not trying to make you feel rushed. I mean, everyone's at their own pace, but I want you to feel empowered to just experiment and try things. Doesn't mean you have to move your stuff over right away or anything like that. Continue your continuity with wherever your data is and do the best you can to protect it and safeguard it, but also be learning something new. That might mean just blowing that dust off an old laptop, throwing an extra stick of RAM in there, maybe throw an SSD in there that you got from eBay or something cheap, refurbished, or bought on market, like local marketplace or Craigslist. Hell, go to XMR Bazaar. Maybe you have some stuff laying around in the basement, boxes of old computer parts and stuff. Throw it on XMR Bazaar. Sell it for Monero. You know, if you want to stack Monero and participate in a circular economy or Bitcoin, then, you know, maybe dabble, experiment. Just say, hey, I've got this. I'm looking right now into my the other side of my basement. I know I've got a stack of like 10 AMD RX 580s for one of my old mining rigs. And I think I've even got another mining rig in the garage stacked with cards. I should just sell all those. $100 a card, $50 a card in Monero. Otherwise, they're just going to sit there and rot. And those AMD cards could be useful for someone, and they might be willing to pay $50 Monero. Boom. Just made Monero. Now you have Monero to pay for your Molvad VPN, right? Now you have Monero to pay for this or that, or maybe you flip it to Bitcoin and now you can pay for that Silent Link eSIM you want. You know, I mean, I'm just saying, like, start thinking outside the box. Start thinking about like how you want to tackle. And if you're not technical, that's okay. Find someone who is. Connect with a group. Come into the chat. I don't know, you know, start somewhere, but you got to start somewhere. Like if you say, I really want to use Graphene OS, but I'm not comfortable installing it, come into the chat. I'll walk you through it. Like seriously, a lot of the stuff is really easy to do. Most of it can be done through the web browser. Installing Graphene OS, Did you know that you can install the entire operating system through the web browser? Don't even need to open a command line. There's no ADB tools you need to install. Nothing. You can do it through the web browser, 100%. So a lot of these things have gotten so easy. And that's why I talk about Start9, Umbral, Casa OS, Docker. There's different even tools for managing Docker. There are great tools I just learned about. I didn't even know about because I was watching a YouTube video the other night from Tech Hut. Great guy. Great videos. I was watching some of his Proxmox videos, and he installed a package that basically was like a server admin web interface for Linux. And I was like, dude, that is pretty cool. I mean, he had Ubuntu server running. I forget the name of the damn package he installed off the top of my head, but I'm sure you can just look it up. I hate saying the word Google, but you know what I'm saying. And basically, it was a web interface. He just logged in as root, and he could create his users. He could create install Samba and do all this stuff. I was like, what? I mean, it kind of reminded me of an old web interface I used to use on Red Hat Linux. That kind of was similar, but they have this stuff. Like, so if you're not super comfortable with the command line, my whole point is there's a lot of tools that will let you do a lot of administration through the web browser. So, yeah, jump on the open source bandwagon. Like, start considering using Linux for your desktop. Linux is getting awesome. And with all the developments that are happening within the gaming community around, like, SteamOS running on Arch Linux and all that kind of stuff, I, as a casual gamer, am super excited. And I think that we're getting closer. You can right now install Bazite, like, on any various hardware and have, like, a SteamOS experience. That's all from the power of, like, all the development that they've done. And gaming on Linux is getting bigger and bigger. It seems like consoles are slowly, especially the Xbox Series X. I read an article that they only sold 2 million consoles in 2024, which is laughable. Things are moving towards PCs and desktops and things of that nature. I'm also getting excited about some of the ARM technology that's coming out from, like, Snapdragon and AMD and these different things to be able to run, like, super fast Linux for, like, video editing environments and stuff, because that is my goal. My goal is, I'm not giving myself, like, a drop dead date or anything, but the better DaVinci Resolve and Affinity and these different things can run on Linux and gaming, like, what is the point? I mean, first of all, Windows is dead to me, especially Windows 10 is dying at the end of the year. No longer going to be supported. Windows 11's no go for me ever, with Recall and Copilot and all this other spyware crap. And no thanks. I don't think I'll ever, hopefully ever, run a Windows 11 or higher environment. So my only choice, especially if you want to play games, is Linux. That's it. It's my only option. I got to make it work. I got to find a way to make it work. And it works really well for me anyways. I'm just saying, like, find some things that you say, I can't live without, and I need to find a workaround, and just try to do that one thing. Maybe you say, you know what? All right, I'm just going to install Umbral. I'm just going to install Start OS. I'm just going to install, you know, Ubuntu with Casa and install Casa OS. Casa OS is literally, you copy one command line, paste it into your terminal, hit enter, boom, it's installed. Literally a copy and paste. That's it. It's one curl command. And it does the rest. The rest is all done through the web browser. How cool is that? You could run an open source server on a laptop, put Ubuntu Linux on there, install Casa OS, start playing around. Like, if you're super newbie, like, that's kind of where I would start. As you get more advanced, you'll run, like, Start OS or Docker or, you know, maybe Proxmox like me. I'm not even there yet. That's where my path is leading me to. You know, having everything virtualized, my entire home lab virtualized everything instead of, like, oh, I have this server for this and this server for that, like, put it all in a VM. Anyways, I'm rambling, but I hope you can hear the excitement in my voice, because I feel like, yes, there's a lot of negative things out there going on. There's a lot of positive things too. And I feel more empowered than ever to keep pushing, keep learning, experimenting, and trying new stuff. So that's what I want to encourage you to do. And I want you to encourage you to talk to your friends and family, right? Be that weirdo, like, embrace the weird. Whether you're talking about, hey, let's try to move to Signal. Hey, maybe you would consider a different operating system, because it looks like Apple and Google are going to start having to participate with law enforcement and breaking encryption and backdooring to, you know, providing backdoor access to their users' data. And that should concern you, right? It's a long road talking to people. You sound like a crazy moron sometimes, but I mean, it's kind of what it takes. And if you're listening to me, you are already there. So be an advocate for the rest. And that's pretty much it. Come join us in the chat. Hit me up on the socials. I am mostly been hanging out on Nostr and Mastodon. That's pretty much the two places where I'm kind of chilling and having a good time. So if that sounds like fun, hit me up over there. Otherwise, you can always shoot me an email, simon@closednetwork.io. And that's it. That's all I got for this episode, y'all. I hope you're having a great February. And we'll see ya. I'm trying to look at the calendar. I'm not exactly sure I'm going to get the next episode out, but I'm trying to do two a month. I'm trying to stick to it. All right, so I'll catch you on the flip side. Later. Watch me win again and win again and win again. I know it's probably getting on me and when I'm sending them. So if I ever win again, it's nobody the minimum. I